From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The arms siege in West Texas is over, though two more members are being sought. We'll look at the Republic of Texas and what they want. As President Clinton heads to Mexico, we'll speak with a union activist in Mexico City. And Indonesian activists are sentenced to prison for pro-democracy activities. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Asking San Franciscans to honor every death, value every life. Thousands of people marched somberly through the heart of the city in a candlelight vigil yesterday, remembering those who've died of AIDS. San Francisco was among more than 350 cities and 46 countries worldwide taking part in the International AIDS Candlelight Memorial and Mobilization, created in San Francisco 14 years ago. Cigarette makers negotiating with state attorneys general to settle the tobacco wars reportedly would accept a ban on most workplace smoking and new warning labels in exchange for some protection from lawsuits. The attorneys general told the industry last week not to return to the talks, which were set to resume today in Dallas, seeking full protection from six smokers' lawsuits. As a result, the companies are struggling to win partial legal immunity in a deal. The industry already has proposed paying $300 billion to settle suits by 24 states and six smokers and agreeing to numerous restrictions on advertising and sales. It was calm in Boulder, Colorado early today after two straight nights of violent clashes between police and college students demanding a right to drink alcohol and to party. Businesses in the Hill District near the University of Colorado campus complied with the police request to close early last night, and a concert was canceled at a popular nightclub. Goodyear and the United Steelworkers Union announced a tentative contract agreement Saturday night that may eventually end a strike that has idled 12,000 workers in seven states for 2 weeks. Details of the six-year deal were not disclosed. Employees will not go back to work until the proposal is ratified by union members. This, according to the union and company, these votes are scheduled soon. In international news, Nobel Peace Laureate Desmond Tutu yesterday made an impassioned plea to South Africans across the political spectrum who were involved in apartheid-era crimes to request amnesty within the next 6 days. Tutu was speaking on a television program dedicated to the work of his Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He emphasized the deadline for amnesty is May 10th and that anyone who has not come forward to confess is liable for criminal prosecution. Peru's Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement is moving its remaining fighters from their jungle headquarters toward the capital, Lima, to carry out selective attacks. At least this according to a local paper, the Daily Espresso. The pro-government newspaper added a warning had been sent to all diplomatic missions in Lima to beef up security in case an attack was being planned similar to the MRTA's spectacular December 17th takeover of the Japanese ambassador's residence. This news from Northern Ireland, Gerry Adams, head of the IRA's political wing Sinn Féin, said new British Prime Minister Tony Blair has the power to revitalize Northern Ireland's quest for peace, and he pledges to play his part. But Adams, speaking after President Clinton called for an Irish Republican Army truce, signaled that the conditions demanded by the IRA were not yet in place. The British province has been more unstable in recent months after a series of IRA attacks in England as well as in Northern Ireland, which prompted revenge strikes by pro-British Protestants. Guerrillas. Adams' election to Parliament, along with another senior Sinn Féin party official last Friday, was seen by Irish media as strengthening peace hopes. And in his first meeting with the rebel leader who is trying to overthrow him, Zaire's dictator Mobutu Sese Seko has said he will relinquish power, but only to a transitional authority that would organize national elections. At a meeting on a South African warship in the Congolese port of Pointe Noire, Mobutu's foe, Laurent Kabila, insisted that power be handed over to him directly. He vowed to press ahead with his military campaign against the government. South African President Nelson Mandela, who has been trying trying to broker an agreement, said after a day of talks that the two sides had agreed to meet in 6 to 8 days to resume negotiations. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The 7-day standoff between police and an armed Texan independence group ended this weekend after the group's leader, Richard McLaren, and 4 others surrendered to authorities near the town of Fort Davis in West Texas. 2 other Republic of Texas group members escaped into the Davis Mountains, and planes and helicopters continue to scour miles of rugged terrain searching for them. Joining us to talk a little more about the Republic of Texas Independence Group is journalist and author Debbie Nathan, who spent this past Christmas with the Republic of Texas in a makeshift fortress near Fort Davis. She's the author of Women and Other Aliens, Essays from the U.S.-Mexico Border, and Satan's Silence, Ritual Abuse and the Making of a Modern American Witch Hunt. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Debbie.
Hi.
Well, why don't we start off by you just telling us, as this siege ends, although 2 members are still being sought by U.S. authorities, who the Republic of Texas is?
Well, the Republic of Texas is actually 3 or 4 factions, but the faction that I got to know was the one that was holed up near Fort Davis, as you said. And that particular group, their leader is Rick McLaren, as everybody knows by now, who is a former vintner, an organic wine farmer. And it's really a right-wing populist group, but I think it's a very interesting group, and looking at it should sort of give us some lessons in what, you know, how to respond to this thing, which is called the militia movement, which I think, but it's much more complicated than people think. I was surprised when I got to know them to find out that they weren't racist, they weren't anti-Semitic, they were not anti-choice. They definitely are anti-government. They're sort of like populist libertarians. But one of the people who's in custody now, McLaren's bodyguard, is an inducted member of the Cherokee Nation, Robert Otto. When I was there, they had a woman who said that she was Jewish. Their president, who at the time that I knew them was their vice president, but now apparently is their titular president, is a black man. So they are really something different than I think people think of militias. They're not really a militia either. All of this started 4 months ago, this standoff, when the government, the Texas government, got really tired of McLaren's practice of filing liens, in other words, legal warrants against people's property and against the property of the state and the banks of Texas, the newspapers. The people I met really didn't seem like they wanted violence so much as they wanted. They had this quixotic idea that you could achieve liberation by litigation, and it struck me as very crazy, but also very poignant. This all started when a judge, a West Texas judge, slapped McLaren with a contempt citation because he didn't respond to the judge's demands that he stop filing liens. And at that point, McLaren holed up, and militias started sort of coming to the group like flies on honey.
But why does McLaren file these liens? What are they?
They say that that the property, whatever property it is, whether it's his neighbor's property or the Vatican and everything in between, belongs to this Republic of Texas, particularly the Texas property, okay, because Texas is supposed to be an outlaw entity, the state of Texas, that doesn't really exist because, according to McLaren's argument, Texas is independent and was never legally annexed to the United States. So he goes into court and he tries to take over all the property of the state.
Have you heard about their national anthem, the Texas Republic National Anthem?
How does that go? No.
Lean on me. We're talking to Debbie Nathan, and she did a piece in the Texas Observer called Christmas in the Texas Republic. And she did spend Christmas in the Texas Republic. She spent Christmas with Richard McLaren as well as others. You also point out that they have an unusual way of putting their names, I guess, like Richard Lance, McLaren.
Yeah, well, I was on the internet a lot. They did have a very active website. There's a discussion group that people can still join. There's still 3 other factions of the Republic of Texas who are not armed or they're not militias, and they're still, I mean, the Republic of Texas still exists. But everyone seems to sign their name with a comma between the first name and the last name, and I couldn't figure this out, and it was very disturbing to me when I spoke with the people at the compound and asked them, why do you put this comma between your first name and last name? And they told me they'd learned this in school, in public school in Texas. And I grew up in Texas and went to public school. And I said, you guys are nuts. I never learned this. But I found out, actually, the other day I found out that this has to do with the Patriot Movement. Apparently, you know, right-wing, the Patriot Movement is this is scary. It's a 5 million member movement, which ranges from John Birchism to neo-Nazism in the United States. And they apparently do this. It's some sort of self-protection against the government. I'm not quite sure what it is, but what's disturbing to me, I guess this comma issue brings up the fact that the people I met, I felt, were, as I said, like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, well-meaning people driven crazy by things like NAFTA, job displacement, but they are willing to do, to follow McLaren, they're willing to espouse beliefs that they haven't investigated, they don't know why they're doing the things they're doing. They need to be intervened in by, if they have conspiracy theories about why the world is so screwed up and why things have gone so bad in the United States, they need to have progressives speaking to them and debunking all of these crazy theories. They really are so susceptible to anything that they hear, but they're not hearing anything good. They're not hearing anything other than caricatures about what's wrong with the world.
Now, McLaren, you write that actually the whole idea of the Republic of Texas he took on after he took up his anti-government stance.
Well, I'm not sure. I think that all of this goes in tandem. If you go back to Richard McLaren's history, he moved to this very isolated area, which looks isolated, but actually is a resort area in West Texas where people go out and they buy land to build little summer homes. He went in there in the late 70s, and he didn't really want to be a summer house guy. He wanted to start a winery, an organic winery. So he got into a lot of trouble with the neighbors because they didn't want commercial activity in this area. And they tried to kick him out, and in the process of fighting this, he discovered that the whole area had been poorly surveyed. And that's when he started getting into legal records and survey documents, and he also apparently made contact with the county sovereignty movement in New Mexico, which is another right-wing movement that wants to remove federal grazing land control from the federal government. They've actually passed a law out there in Catron County, and then there have been subsequent laws all over the West, which are trying to remove control of the federal government, you know, remove control of these lands. So they told him, hey, why don't you just administrate the government to death? That's what we do. And in fact, they have been successful. At that point, I think this age-old belief, which I remember learning in school, which I think is based on a bunch of post-Civil War anger and states' rights obsession in Texas, but the belief that Texas has always had the right to secede and that Texas, you know, was never really a state, that's a myth in Texas culture. I learned it myself. I think he sort of picked that up by osmosis from living in Texas and combined it with this idea that you could sue the government. And that's where all of this really started.
Debbie Nathan, how does the Republic of Texas fit in with the wise use movement? And what about McLaren becoming quite exercised about the Nature Conservancy?
As I said, he has connections, very close connections, with the county rural movement, which is similar to the wise use movement, this Catron County, New Mexico movement. You know, the idea is that you take control on a countywide basis of land so that you can supposedly remove them from federal control, but actually what happens is you open them up to corporate exploitation by putting them in the county. So I would say that he has a close relationship with the wise use movement.
And what about the Nature Conservancy?
You know, the Nature Conservancy, I think, has been they're trying to buy land out there, or they have bought land, and I don't understand why he hates the Nature Conservancy in that area based on his personal experience. I think that it really has to do more with what he's picked up from national wise use ideology. Because he was an organic vintner, so, you know, one would think that he's interested in preserving nature, conserving things, but as I said, this is not a rational movement. You can't look at it that way. I think it makes much more sense to look at Rick McLaren and what's happened and the people around him by looking at people's real grievances in this country, the grievances of people in the heartland. When I spoke with the people at Christmas who were around him, They talked about having been displaced from jobs. They talked about downsizing. They talked about their jobs having left the country. They talked about their children. These are working-class white people down in little towns, you know, in Texas. They talked about their kids maybe being busted in a government sting for smoking a joint. These are realities now in people's lives, and I think that they indicate, I do agree, you know, that there is this paranoid sort of law and order government attitude that's affecting people who, you know, white people who were not affected by these things a generation ago. It's very shocking. I think they have real concerns, and nobody's speaking to those concerns except for the right, and especially the ultra-right.
We're talking to Debbie Nathan, who did a piece in the Texas Observer called Christmas in the Texas Republic. Today, Timothy McVeigh's sister is expected to testify at the Oklahoma City bombing trial about her brother's political views, saying that, you know, of course, he was anti-government. How did the Republic of Texas in December, where the time you spent with them, how did they respond to what happened in Oklahoma?
They, to me, seemed very anti-violence. They did not seem drawn towards, you know, when you look on the internet right now at ultra-right discussion lists, all I'm seeing now are these explanations about why Timothy McVeigh really didn't do it, and maybe it was Arabs. They didn't seem interested in that. They eschewed violence. They really, you know, didn't seem, I mean, they have these conspiracy theories about that the government's behind everything bad. I wouldn't be surprised if we talked about it now if they would say that maybe it was Arabs, but I don't think that would be because they were racist. But I didn't get the feeling that they were very invested, you know what I'm saying, in conspiracy theories about that event in particular.
Yet, how does, you say that they're not racist, and yet part of the whole fight to have Texas become a separate republic, can you trace that back to the Confederacy?
No, I know why you're bringing that up, because in the article that I wrote, I actually looked at 1,500 pages of their magnum opus suit against the federal government, where they put all of their historical documents in, making their case. So among those 1,500 pages, there is the secession document of 1861, where Texas leaves the United States. And that's one of their arguments, you know, that Texas, well, first they believe that Texas was illegally annexed in 1845, and Texas was a republic from 1836 to 1845. Without going into a lot of explanation, I'll just say that I don't think they have any argument, good argument about that. I think it was legally annexed. But Texas did leave the United States and was a nation for about one day in 1861, but then very willingly joined the Confederacy with a very, very racist document. So they include that document as part of their argument that Texas, you know, is a nation. But it's again, totally mooted by the fact that Texas willingly went back in and did a constitution and a vote in 1876. I don't like to dwell too much on the racism of the 1861 document. I think it's another example, and I put it in the article, because I think it's an example of how they don't even know what their own historical texts or their arguments really, really include, you know, that they do use a racist text. I don't think they've read it. I think they're much more interested in the part of the text that shows that Texas was a nation for one day. So, and I find when I talk to people that there's almost an obsession, you know, to look at every single group and say, well, look, even though they've got an American, you know, Native American in their group and a black vice president, they must really be racist. And I think that's totally the wrong way to look at any particular group involved with the far right. I think you have to look at, I mean, the Republic of Texas has always said that citizenship is open to anybody, regardless of ethnicity or race or gender or whatever. And they absolutely, you know, disavow racism in their public pronouncements. So I think that to just out of hand try to dismiss every single group based on this idea that each one of them unilaterally is racist, sexist, anti-abortion. By the way, the Republic of Texas doesn't believe in a state religion, so, you know, they're not all Christian. That doesn't give us a space to try to think about how the left or how progressives, how people who are really interested in equality and power sharing in this country really need to go and talk to people who've been infected and drawn into the far right. Helen Prejean, you know, the author of Dead Man Walking, put it well, I think. She said, and as she goes out and looks at people's attitudes towards the death penalty, she says that popular support for the death penalty seems to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And I believe that that's true for the many millions of people who have been driven really to the point of craziness by all of this economic and social dislocation that you know, people really have not had a democratic hand in managing economic change in this country.
Well, Debbie Nathan, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, Debbie Nathan, a freelance journalist who spent Christmas with the Republic of Texas and wrote a piece for the Texas Observer called Christmas in the Texas Republic. Thanks for being with us and enlightening us on this group, and we'll see what happens with them as two members have now escaped from the compound and authorities are looking for them. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at the Mexico that President Clinton is visiting today. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton travels to Mexico later today for his first official trip to a Latin American country. The 5-day trip, which includes stops in Costa Rica and Barbados, is expected to focus on trade, illegal drugs, and immigration. Meanwhile, this news from San Cristobal de las Casas, Mexico. Supporters of Mexico's Zapatista guerrillas sent a message to President Clinton yesterday that he's not welcome in Mexico, linking him to the Mexican government repression. And the Committee of Indigenous Political Prisoners also denounced a Mexican government decision to expel 12 European human rights workers based in the southern state of Chiapas, the center of the Zapatista uprising more than 3 years ago. 11 of the 12 are contesting their expulsions in court. We're going to talk to two people in this segment. First, Enrique Somo joins us. He's the U.S. correspondent for the magazine Proceso, a progressive publication based in Mexico. He also writes for El Universal, one of Mexico's two main newspapers, and he speaks to us from Mexico City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, today also happens to be Cinco de Mayo. Can you tell us the significance of this day in Mexico?
Well, Cinco de Mayo is one of the main dates that expresses the long struggle of Mexico for independence and in defense of its sovereignty. As you know, it is in Cinco de Mayo, in the 5th of May, the Mexican army and the Mexican people, supported by the people of the surroundings, led a battle against the French invasion, which was trying to establish in Mexico an empire with an Austrian king, supported by the French. And so the Mexican victory came after a long series of struggle for independence, first of all against Spain, because Mexico was a colony of Spain. Spain tried to reconquer Mexico in 1829, then after that against the French in 1835, and then in the war against the United States, in which Mexico lost half of its territory, not so much because of the difference of strength between the two armies, but a cause of the corruption that existed in the Mexican elites at that time. So the 5th of May is one of the dates that signals the struggle for independence of Mexico.
Some might see a great deal of irony in President Clinton visiting on this day, celebrating Mexico's sovereignty, considering that many see NAFTA as a way to take away sovereignty from Mexico.
Well, tell you the truth, the two countries have a multilateral relation that is very complex and that none of the two countries can ignore. We have a border of 3,000 kilometers in which we have around 250 million crossings every year. We have a trade agreement. We have the problem of drugs that is a plague in both countries, not only the United States, but Mexico too. We have problems of oil prospects in the Gulf of Mexico, which are disputed between the two countries. And we, naturally, Mexicans, have an enormous population in the United States, and the United States has many Americans living in Mexico. So these multilateral relations can only be solved through negotiation. But the truth is that we are two countries with a very different strength, economically and as a power speaking. And these differences are exploited sometimes by American interests to create a dependency relation between Mexico and the United States. But I think that the people of both countries are interested in a much more equal relation and just relation between the two countries.
Last week, on Thursday, May 1st, May Day, there were more than 10,000 people. Is this right? This is the reports I saw in Mexico City marching in the streets, many of them denouncing President Clinton.
Well, I don't know where you saw 10,000.
There
were 300.
300?
300,000. Yes.
300,000.
300,000 in two enormous marches that coincided in the Zócalo of Mexico, which is enormous, as you know, and can host about 500,000 people. And those were marches of independent unions, because, as you know, the main union movement is controlled by Mexican government, is a kind of, has a pact, a corporative pact with the Mexican government, but those were independent unions which were protesting mainly for the economic policies, the lack of democracy, and demanding peace in Chiapas, among other things. And you had their workers for all sectors of Mexican economy, peasants, a lot of peasants, and people from democratic and progressive organizations, too.
I wonder if we're going to see much news of this. To put President Clinton's visit in context, the kind of activity, pro-democracy activity that's going on in Mexico City.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you that many, many Mexicans, I would say most Mexicans, are conscious that we have to deal with the relations between the two countries in a very intelligent way. And there is no point in exaggerating the contradictions that exist, because there exist two common interests between the two countries. So we have to deal with both of them. In this sense, I think that President Clinton did not choose a good time to come to the country, because before that we had two abysmal months, especially related to this business of certification and about the question of immigration between the two countries. I understand the United States has the right to decide how many immigrants it wants to have. But it should take into account a fact that exists. And the fact is that for 100 years, an enormous movement of population between the two countries has been going on. And that millions and millions of Mexicans, and this movement of population has been welcomed very often by the United States. And that millions of people have interests on both sides of the border. So if you adopt laws, you have to take into account the human rights and the legitimate interests that have created those families on both sides of the border.
Enrique Somo, I want to thank you very much for joining us, the U.S. correspondent for the magazine Proceso. We are speaking to him in Mexico City. And following up on the activities of last week, the third of a million people who marched in Mexico City, labor activists, union members, last month at the Labor Notes Conference in Detroit, Michigan, where some 1,000 rank-and-file activists met to put the movement back in labor in this country, I had a chance to talk to some of the labor activists from Mexico, including Hector de la Cueva. He works with CELAS, which is a Mexico City group that advises, trains, and conducts labor research for trade unions. And I started by asking him how NAFTA has affected the union movement in Mexico.
Well, it affected a lot because NAFTA made deeper the economic crisis in Mexico and the social crisis. Since NAFTA started, we lost 1 million jobs. And they promised to the Mexicans that with NAFTA we could get more and better jobs. And we got less and worse jobs. They promised us that the Mexicans could have better salaries, and we have now worse salaries. So the privatization process is also accelerating. And so in many ways, the social and economic crisis is deepened now in Mexico. So the unions were affected because they are facing a lot of problems in the workplaces. And at the same time, because this social, economic, and political crisis that we are living in Mexico, we are facing very deep changes in the unions. All the Mexican labor movement are changing now. The old labor congress is divided. Several unions representing more than 2 million workers are discussing to create a new organization. So everything is changing now in the Mexican labor movement.
Is it also true that the dues that union members pay to the pre-union, some of it goes to the actual political party?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a two-way street because, yes, the centrals put money in the PRI from the members, and the government put money in the leaders' pockets, right? So it's part of the corporative and corrupted system.
The CTM, the pre-confederation of unions, did they support NAFTA?
They support everything that the Mexican government wants, right? So they support NAFTA and the leaders, I mean.
So what about the rank and file? What about the workers?
The workers are against the NAFTA. Maybe when NAFTA start, many workers could maybe believe in the promises of NAFTA. And many people in Mexico believe in the Salinas promises. But now the Mexican people had broke with these dreams that Salinas sold to the Mexicans. And now Salinas is the most hated former president in the Mexican history. So now the people, for the Mexican people and the Mexican workers, is clear that NAFTA is nothing to do with the promises, Salinas' promises, and they are against NAFTA.
Again, we're talking to Hector de la Cueva, who is with CELAS in Mexico City, which does advising, training, and research for unions within Mexico. You mentioned earlier that under NAFTA you've lost jobs, but where have these jobs gone? They certainly haven't come to the United States.
I think now with NAFTA, the question is not which country win with NAFTA, but who in our countries win. And it's clear that a few people, very rich people, won with NAFTA in U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and the majority of the people from Canada, U.S., and Mexico lost with NAFTA.
Which people or which companies in Mexico won?
In first place, the transnationals, because that's part of the lies of the NAFTA, because it's, it seemed like a trade between countries. But in fact, the trade from Mexico to U.S. is mainly from the same U.S. companies, right? It's Ford, Chrysler, GM, and other transnational exporting from Mexico to U.S. and Canada. So these transnationals and some Mexicans associated with these transnationals won with NAFTA. But many employers are now against NAFTA because even a lot of employers broke with NAFTA.
Has NAFTA speeded up the process of privatization of public sector areas?
Yeah, absolutely. In the oil industry, electrical industry, and even in very vital sectors like education and social security. Now even those sectors are in a process of privatizing. So it's a very bad experience.
And what's happening in the maquiladoras on the border?
Well, the maquiladoras are growing. And that's part of the problem because the few jobs we got are very bad jobs with no labor protection. And any international standards are guaranteed in those maquiladoras. So we have a lot of workers now in the north border with very bad jobs, with no labor protection, not health and safety, and not environmental standards. So that's the situation there.
Where do the Zapatistas fit into this, the Zapatista uprising in 1994, and what has happened since?
Well, the Zapatistas upsurge in 1994 coincided with NAFTA, the starting of NAFTA, January 1st of 1994. The uprising showed that NAFTA was a lie in first place. And the Zapatistas uprising accelerated, I think, the political crisis inside the regime because you are talking about a big deep crisis inside the government. They are killing themselves and so on. So now the government was forced to negotiate it with the Zapatistas movement. But again, the Mexican government lied because they signed an agreement around the indigenous rights to have a reform, a constitutional reform, to recognize the indigenous rights. And the government, the last year, signed the agreements. And now Mexican government are saying that they don't recognize these agreements. So the dialogue and the negotiations between the Mexican government and the Zapatista movement are broke, are suspended. The war could start again in any moment. And it seems like even some sectors of the Mexican government are trying to provocate new confrontations with the Zapatistas army. So it's a very dangerous situation, and it will not resolve if the Mexican government don't recognize the agreement that the government already signed the last year.
Can you explain Article 27 and where it fits in to NAFTA and how it fits in also to the Zapatista uprising?
Yeah, well, the 27 article of the Mexican Constitution basically was a result of the Mexican Revolution at the beginning of the century, and it provides the national property of many things, land, oil, electricity, and so on. Some very, very basic things. The original 27 article defined as a national property. So Salinas changed before to adapt the Constitution to NAFTA. He changed the 27 article, and now everything could be sell, right? It's a part of the privatization. Now it's possible to privatize the land and electricity and so on. So it's a very counter-reform against the Mexican Revolution gains. So the Zapatistas uprising, one of the main issues was to recover this national concept of the land and the rights of the peasants.
Has Zedillo been an improvement over Salinas, or not at all?
Zedillo is a bad student of Salinas, right? He is applying the same politics that Salinas did, but he's not enough intelligent than Salinas, so he's worse, right? And even because the Zedillo government is very weak, he is doing more and more. He is supporting on the Mexican army in a very dangerous way, because we are facing the militarization of not only of the indigenous communities in all the country, but even in the cities, even in Mexico City, the army is now in charge of the police in entire zones of the Mexico City. And more colonels and people from the army are in charge of several things. So we are facing a very dangerous militarization of the country.
You've been listening to Hector de la Cueva with CELAS, which is a labor research, training, and consulting group in Mexico City. I met him a couple weeks ago at the Labor Notes Conference in Detroit, Michigan, where American union activists from around the country, about 1,000 of them, gathered, as well as activists from places like Mexico and other parts of the world, to form a solidarity network of labor in this country, as well as other places like Mexico. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to another country, and that is Indonesia. There are elections planned for a few weeks from now, although they are considered a sham. But most importantly, right now, a trial has been going on where 12 pro-democracy activists were sentenced, two more expected to be sentenced. We're going to find out more about that. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesia, the fourth largest country in the world, will be holding parliamentary elections later this month. But the government has already announced it expects to get more than 70% of the vote. As the New York Times editorialized yesterday, this is not evidence of advanced polling techniques, but rather old-style political control by Indonesian dictator Suharto. Elections in Indonesia are a sham. Under ordinary circumstances, the fake elections might just be ignored. But this year is different. The campaign finance scandal rocking the Clinton White House has cast the spotlight on the Riady family, a wealthy Indonesian business family with close ties to the dictator. Also, the Indonesian government has launched a fierce crackdown on pro-democracy activists. You may have heard about Mukhtar Pakpahan. We had him on Democracy Now!, the leading labor activist in Indonesia, who is in jail right now. The AFL-CIO has launched a campaign for his release. But also, after a lengthy show trial, 12 other pro-democracy activists with the People's Democratic Party, known as the PRD, were handed stiff prison sentences last week for alleged subversive activities. Two more are expected to be sentenced this week, as early as today. Joining us to talk about the staged elections and also the crackdown on dissent in Indonesia are two guests. We'll begin with Sidawati. That's not her real name, but she is going by a pseudonym to protect herself and her family still in Indonesia. She's a pro-democracy activist close to the outlawed People's Democratic Party, and she's now traveling in the United States. We're also joined by John Whitman, also not his real name, a solidarity activist around Indonesia and the head of the PRD Defense Fund here in the United States. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Well, it's good to be here.
Hi.
Hi. Why don't we start with you, Sidawati? Can you tell us about this trial that is just finishing up in Indonesia with the sentencing of so far 12 of the PRD pro-democracy activists?
Well, the trial began on December 12, 1996, and there were 14 activists were put on trial in relation. In the beginning, they were charged of masterminding the riot in relations to the attack on PDI headquarters on July. So they were arrested right after the riot.
Just to clarify for our listeners, those riots that took place on July 27th were around Megawati, who is the head of the PDI, which is the opposing party in Indonesia. And Suharto, the dictator, tried to get her kicked out as head of that party. She's the daughter of the founding president of Indonesia, Sukarno. And as a result of trying to get her kicked out and raiding her offices, these riots took place.
Yeah, so the PRD activists were arrested right after the riot and accused as masterminding the riot. And then, but the charge changed as they were arrested because the prosecutor could not find any evidence. So they were brought to court with a different charge of subversion. And during the process of the trial, they were just accused as diverting from the state ideology, from defaming the president, from not admitting the success of New Order. That's the end of the charges. But basically, they were arrested for something else, but they were charged for a different thing.
Can you describe who these young people are, who these 14 people are?
They were, some of them are already graduated, just graduated from university, but most of them were university students. And they were students who work with, who organized workers and peasants and students for democracy in Indonesia.
And so the trial took place. What was the trial like?
The trial was very clear that there's a certain target that the government like to reach by doing this trial. So from the very beginning, it was full of schemes and then unfair treatments against the defendants. For example, before the trial began, they already protested that the fact that they were arrested without warrant and kept in the military intelligence office for a week without being allowed to access to lawyers and a family. So according to Indonesian criminal code, that's against a broad procedure. But when they demanded the court to attend to this matter, the court just dismissed it. That's the first step. And then another thing was that they were only allowed to bring 4 witnesses, and they could not even ask for 4 more. And so it was just their demand just kept being dismissed. And then another thing was the prosecutors only present several witnesses up to like February for 2 months. And then after that, the prosecutors just read testimonies of the witnesses, which was forced to give testimony in a way. So
the PRD defendants refused to cooperate?
Yeah, so they refused to cooperate. So finally, they just boycotted the trial. They walked out of the trial several times, and then in the end, they just boycotted the court altogether, and they dismissed the lawyers on the basis that there's no point of continuing to follow the legal procedure if they could not give a fair trial to them.
I was just reading something about the trial that says wearing black headbands with the slogan "Democracy is dead" and T-shirts stating "Boycott the elections" and singing songs such as "We Shall Overcome." They entered the courtroom under guard, told the judges they didn't recognize the authority of the court. And that was what happened on April 28th, when the judges then read out their sentences to the cheers of 200 supporters who were first cleared out before they read the sentences. Of course, they weren't cheering for the sentences.
Yeah, if I could say something here.
Yes,
John. I think the significance of these trials is that it has shown to the Indonesian public a group of youths who are, you know, no older than 28, some of them are 20 years old, who are extremely determined in their opposition to the Suharto government. And this is almost unprecedented to find such youths who are themselves a product of the New Order, who have grown up entirely under the period of Suharto's dictatorship, who have come out and called Suharto a dictator, who have not been deferential, who have not been intimidated by this whole state apparatus of military intelligence and police and prosecutors and show trials, who have suffered torture, who are likely to be imprisoned for another 10, 15 years for some of them. They have not been intimidated at all. They were defiant to the last. And this itself was a kind of shock to the New Order government, which has never had to face this type of opposition, especially from the youth.
What kind of press coverage did it get in Indonesia? The press, which is, to say the least, very severely limited, the three leading magazines last year being shut down, even though they're, well, the equivalent of sort of the Time and Newsweek of the United States.
Well, it was quite interesting that the press coverage were quite sympathetic to the PRD defendants and the family, because they just presented the fact that the PRD defendants were defiant against the government, and they gave a full story about the response of the mothers of the defendants and what the mothers say in defense of their kids, of their persecuted children. So I was quite surprised to see that the press actually give a objective coverage of the trial.
What about the role of women in this trial, both the mothers and also Dita Sari, who is the union leader, who was one of the 14 people tried, and she ended up getting 6 years?
Mm-hmm. So the mothers have been standing together in defense of the children, so they didn't back up at all. They went to the National Commission for Human Rights to demand the release of the children because, as I said before, that they were arrested and charged with different charge than what they were charged now. And then they only 2 weeks ago, they went to the Supreme Court and demanded that they just released the defendants and demanded a lesser sentence, at least if they're indeed wrong. And then they also, some of the defendants' mother could not come to visit them because they're too poor and they live in a different city from Jakarta. So the other mother's defendants would help to take care of the other defendants. And Dita Sari herself is very significant because she's the leader of a trade union, and in a way it gives an example for women in Indonesia to get involved in politics and just lead the workers, who are mostly women.
We're talking to Sita Wati and John Whitman, both not their real names, afraid of repercussions against family and friends in Indonesia, but talking about the trial that just took place of the PRD members, 14 of them, of the People's Democratic Party in Indonesia, two more sentenced, expected to be sentenced sometime this week. Now, as I said earlier, in the trial, they were wearing black headbands and they were saying things like democracy is dead and have referred to the elections. John, what does this mean for the elections to have the newspapers cover people actually saying that the elections are a fraud?
Well, I think it's delegitimated the entire electoral process. This is the seventh election that's going to be upcoming that the Suharto government has staged managed since 1971. And it is the first election that has been so completely delegitimated. The PRD case is only just one factor. I mean, the PRD was attacked because as preparation for securing the elections, as the government likes to say it. So the attack on Megawati first on July 27th, and then the witch hunt against the PRD, this was all part of getting rid of the opposition before the campaigning for the election even began. So this is these were two of the important things that delegitimated the election, because the government had to resort to such brutal and openly crude methods of securing the elections. Also, there's a activist, Sri Bintang, who was arrested in March just for sending out holiday greeting cards for the Muslim Eid, which said boycott the elections. The sight of these PRD youth in front of the judges, denouncing the court, denouncing Suharto, attacking the new order as a whole, attacking the whole principle of military intervention in domestic affairs, this has really energized and inspired their whole generation. This is a new generation of activists, and they've come out swinging. So there are activists who belong to other organizations, like the NU, the Nahdlatul Ulama, who have just issued a statement to boycott the election in defiance of their own organization's adult leadership. The youth have been very inspired. The universities have seen a lot of rallies and demonstrations in favor of boycotting the elections. I mean, boycotting the elections is not going to, have a lot of effect. The elections are going to be run by the government as they wish. But for the government, it's going to be a big signal that it doesn't have any legitimation.
What has happened to Mokhtar Pakpahan, the leading trade union activist who is in jail for subversion? Has his trial begun?
Yes, actually his trial began at the same time with the 12 PRD defendants. But the trial has been suspended because he's been sick. I don't know for how long, but I think it's about a month already that he hasn't attended the trial.
I have news now from Reuters that Jakarta's military chief, Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, has warned of firm action against political party supporters if they continue to hold illegal street parades during Indonesia's election campaign. Gives you a sense of the kind of stage-managed approach that that there are only legal parades, and then there's everything else.
Yeah, it was not even clear what do they mean by legal parades, because the government's party about a week ago attacking the office of the other party, and they claimed that they were just going on a parade, and then they attacked the other office, the other party's office. So. So far, legal or illegal has been defined by the government.
What has the students' defiance and the PRD members' defiance meant for Megawati Sukarnoputri, the daughter of Sukarno, who heads the leading opposition party, if there is one in Indonesia? What has it meant for her, and where does she stand in these elections?
Yeah. Well, if we were talking about the PDI, Megawati's party, last year, we would have sort of scoffed at it and said, well, it's of really no importance. It's one of the three legal parties in Indonesia. It's kind of an established elite organization, and we could have gone on to other more important matters. But because of the attack on Megawati, there have been a lot of people who have come out in support of her, and the people who are nationalists, who are have been influenced by Sukarno, they have come out in thousands for street demonstrations. They've been active ever since July 27th in defending Megawati and defending her leadership of the party. And PRD, which was in a coalition with the PDI under Megawati, was a 30-member coalition, 30 different organizations, was also supporting the PDI just as a, you know, as an opposition to Suharto. In fact, the PRD is now calling for a boycott, but last year they were calling just for monitoring the elections. It was only the attack on the PDI headquarters, the attack on Megawati, and the killing of about 50 people at the PDI headquarters in Jakarta that forced the PRD to call for a boycott of the elections, realizing that, you know, the whole thing was a fraud. And their slogan now is, without Megawati, the elections are invalid.
Well, John and Siduati, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We have come to the end of the show. We'll certainly continue to follow the events in Indonesia. John Whitman and Siduati, not their real names, but Siduati, a pro-democracy activist in Indonesia, now traveling in the United States. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our engineer and assistant producer, Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!